Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
The Museum of Vancouver recently completed renovations on it, a number of its galleries, and is now opening three brand new exhibitions at its location down on the shores of Falls Creek in the same building where the planetarium is. The three exhibitions, Future Makers, featuring custom-made chairs made out of rehabilitated mahogany, the Deep-Seated Histories, chairs from the collection, and the one we're going to talk about today, which I think in many ways is the most interesting of the trio, The Work of Repair, Redress and Repatriation. I had a chance to speak to the curator of this exhibition, Sharon Fortney. The Senior Curator of Indigenous Collections, Engagement and Repatriation, and the lead curator for this exhibition. Since the 1980s, the Museum of Vancouver, or MOV, has been grappling with how to decolonize its work and repair its relationships with Indigenous communities. The Work of Repair, Redress and Repatriation at the Museum of Vancouver digs into some of the efforts by highlighting three ways the MOV is working towards repair: repatriation, community engagement, and research that connects Indigenous belongings to their histories. I had a chance to talk to curator Sharon Fortney down at the gallery on the night before the opening. It's a really interesting discussion that digs into not only what you might see at the gallery, but a lot of the issues that the exhibition is going to be exploring. And we're here looking at the new exhibition, Work of Repair.
Right.
Can you just very quickly tell me what that's about?
Well, it's an exhibition about different types of redress activities that the museum has been doing in the past few years. But it started with an actual repatriation project. So we start first by telling a repatriation story and then go into other types of activities we've been doing.
So the issue of repatriation, because this is, we're looking at First Nations artifacts that are part of the collection. This has been a contentious issue for many years now.
I guess it depends on your position and where you're located. Like, I think in Europe it's been very problematic for some of those like colonial collections that are really holding tightly to some people's heritage from all around the world, but I think in Canada it's been part of museum story for many decades now.
So the issue of repatriation and ownership of the artifacts has always been something that's been part of the Museum of Vancouver's sort of mission?
Well, it started, I think, the very first one started in the 70s, and then there was kind of a little bit of a few decades where it wasn't really common, but in Canada there was a task force report on museums and First Nations in the early 90s, and that's really driven like museum professionals in Canada to look at their practice and address a number of issues, and repatriation has been one of them. So that is actually what the museum's repatriation policy responds to, is that task force report.
Yeah.
So we've been for many decades doing repatriation work here, and I was just looking in our database before I met with you, and I think 470 items have been repatriated. So sometimes, like, it doesn't mean we've done like 470 communities. Like sometimes, you know, like with this repatriation to Shakotin, there were 61 items repatriated. So you can see sometimes it's one item to one community or family or an individual, and sometimes it's, you know, a group of objects or items.
So how does a repatriation process start?
So it could be proactive on the part of the museum in terms that we do care for ancestors here. Mm-hmm. So we will reach out if we have good records on where those ancestors are from and notify the communities. Yeah. And sometimes the communities are ready to do the work, but sometimes they aren't. So we might, you know, they might thank us for telling them, and we might, you know, not hear from them again. Mm-hmm. And then we'll just remind them again, you know, in a few years maybe that there are still ancestors here. Yeah. And other times the communities, you know, they want to do the work, but because of overlapping territories, sometimes it's complicated. And so you might need neighboring communities to state their agreement. Mm-hmm. And they might just say nothing, or so it can sometimes stall it. And then there are instances where we really firmly know something belongs to a community or an individual or family, and then we can move forward. So there's a lot of different ways it happens. Mm-hmm. So right now it's very common to get requests from communities. Do you have anything from our territory? Or do you have something made by this person? And so we will do, look through the database for them, and we will transfer copies of photos and records if we find something that's relevant to them and they want them. So we're doing, I guess, information requests quite frequently.
And I guess because one of the things that, and we'll talk a bit more about the exhibition in a moment, but a component of this is also that information and knowledge sharing recovery component. Can you talk a bit about that? Because that sounds really important.
Yeah, so when I first arrived at the museum in 2017, like, the records were really hard to search for the Indigenous collections. So mm-hmm. one of the reasons they did the Haida Now exhibition is they thought that was one of their largest collections from the Northwest Coast. And when you think of the museum being in Vancouver, in the center of Coast Salish territory, that doesn't actually make a lot of sense, right? Like, right. So the Coast Salish collections are actually larger, but they had made an effort, different people had entered the records, so they weren't consistent and searchable. Mm-hmm. So I had to really, think about how am I going to work with these records to make them easy to use for community members, because if you can't find your belongings in a collection, you can't look at them, you can't study them, I mean, you can't repatriate them, but, I mean, there's just even the basic access of seeing a photo of it, you can't do that, right? So we've spent a lot of time working on improving our records, and I feel really good because I've done a few repatriations where communities have said to us, you guys have the best records. So that makes me feel good, because I spent a lot of time in my museum career doing collections work before I got into curatorial work. And a lot of curators, they're just doing kind of the exhibition and the community engagement, but they maybe aren't as focused on the collections work. So I'm a bit of a jack of all trades when it comes to curation.
It sounds like there's a big role for the Museum of Vancouver, but perhaps all museums, in supporting communities. Because you say you contact them, and sometimes they're not sure what to do with that information.
Yeah, well, it depends where they're situated and how big the community is and what kind of resources they have. So often you'll find communities Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, they're in a city. Yeah. They've got a lot of professional expertise in their community. They're used to engaging widely in the city. They have good resources. They know what they're asking for and what they want. But sometimes you get into smaller communities, and it can be harder for them to know what to ask for, what's the process. So we have our repatriation policy on our website with a portal to our collections database. So we try to make it accessible. And we do host visits for community members several times a year. It happens quite frequently. Or people will sometimes contact me. I'm coming into the city for this. Could I come by and see, things in the collection? And we always try to make it work, even if it's short notice.
Yeah.
But we do try to make it work.
Yeah. And a lot of your collection is going to be not on display, but in storage. So
yeah, that's really common with museums.
Is it easy to take people in to see that?
If they have an appointment.
Yeah.
So we ask try to give us some advance notice. Don't just show up wanting like to come in because we might be in a meeting or somebody might be on their day off, but let us know you're coming if you can, and we'll make an appointment. And we don't say no like too often, like to research requests. It's usually like a capacity reason. We'll say, can you send us another date? But we have a study table in our storage area, and so we frequently host visits down there. Even like, I don't know if you watch ABTN, but like we've had a bunch on there recently with this new show called At Home, where they were kind of decorating with culture and they wanted to come see pieces from different communities. And so we ended up prioritizing that because a lot of the people who were coming in were from like urban communities. You know, they might live in Vancouver, but their nation is somewhere else, and so they didn't really have access to their heritage. So in the end, we prioritized those visits, you know, even though it was like a home decorating show. Yeah. You know, just because it's important for people to know they can come into these public collections and they can see things from their community if they're there, you know.
Right. Yeah. So tell me this, what's the story that this exhibition is telling?
Okay, so the work of repair, it started with the Shakotian repatriation. So that's the first story you walk into. And they asked us, like, they wanted to continue their work with us. They wanted to show people their repatriation experience. And they want to travel this component of the exhibition in their community afterwards. So we had two galleries available, and they only wanted the first gallery. So I had to think of like, oh, what are we going to do with the second gallery then? So I thought, well, we have other like redress initiatives. When you're trying to change your organization, it shouldn't just be one thing. It should be multifaceted. So we bundled like three different projects together under as the work of repair. Yeah. And that's what we're showing here. So the first part is a physical repatriation. The second is about provenance matching and collections research. And then the third activity is a knowledge repatriation community engagement project that I've been doing for several years, which is about, it's like, members of the host nations tell us about things they would like to know more about, like lost knowledge. And then I've been sourcing knowledge holders that can teach that. And we've been filming and doing photography. So that's really focused at the host nations. But people started saying to me, what are you doing with this, Sharon? You need to show some of this. So it's just clips to give people a sense of what we're doing, but not like the full story. But just also to make people think about, with museums especially, it's often knowledge flows out of the community into the museum for an exhibit. But we're trying to change that and have knowledge flowing back into the community. So that's what knowledge repatriation is about. So,
and that sounds like a great service to those communities.
Well, it's part of like when you're partnering with people and you're having a friendship with those people, it's not always, I need this, I need that, this is the time. Like, it's like, what do you need? What can we do for you? And like, there's a power relationship if people are always coming to the museum. Like, there's like an unspoken thing there where you're in the power seat because they're always coming to you. So it's about like us leaving the museum and going out on the land and doing things together. So so I can show you some of that in a minute.
And I guess, you know, another component of is that here at the museum, you know, you have the expertise, your own expertise and training and knowledge to be able to deal with all this material and knowledge, which many small communities don't.
So I see myself, like, when you're an Indigenous curator, Indigenous staff in a museum, you have to be careful that people don't ask you to speak for everyone, right? So your job, like, well, from my perspective, the job is to facilitate. So I have a skill set, and I use it to help the communities either with access or exhibition work or public program development. So that's my role. I'm a facilitator, and I'm sharing and lending my expertise to them. And same with when we designed this exhibition, the Shakotin had a lot of stories they wanted to tell. You know, it's kind of a new thing for them to get into doing exhibition work. And they want this section to travel, but we're trying to be mindful, like, when it's traveling in their territory, it's likely not going to be in a large museum like the Museum of Vancouver. So we had to try to contain it in some way.
Right.
So like you'll see, they really wanted to have a timeline and tell a lot of different historical stories. I encourage them to put it on a monitor. Mm-hmm. Like, so we have sort of a changing slideshow that tells, yeah. So if you want that information, you can stand at the monitor and you can like view it. But if you want a lighter, like more, you just want to look at pretty pictures and feel the celebratory nature of the project,
yeah.
You can do that through photography and film clips in the exhibition. Yeah.
Okay, maybe you can look at some stuff.
Yeah, so you come in and into the territory, and there's little elements throughout the exhibition. Like you see there's juniper boughs. Mm-hmm. Here on the coast, cedar is like a very sacred plant, but for them it's juniper, so they sent juniper down from their territory, and we'll probably be refreshing it throughout the exhibition. But you walk through the juniper, there's stones at the entrance that comes from different parts of their territory. They sent down wood stumps for seating in the theater that had pine beetles in them. Yeah, we had a little trouble with the pine beetles, but we think they're gone now. And then you have, like, we were really lucky because they have these beautiful, like, color photographs. They had Jeremy Williams and Trevor Mack doing documentation of the repatriation and then of some of the work that happened in the community. So it's like to create, like, an immersive experience for visitors. And their original intention was to have some of the baskets that we repatriated in the exhibition. They were going to leave 10 here. And then when they got here, they couldn't leave them. They felt they all had to go home and touch the soil at home. So they said they'd send 10 back. But once they got there, they couldn't part with them. I don't know if, like, they really didn't have any. They had four.
Right.
For six communities, they had four baskets. So they took 29 from this collection. And there's other collections they're hoping to repatriate from in other institutions, but you know, we're okay with that. Like, you know, they're telling their story. They don't have to do it with objects. They can do it with photography film. Yeah. They did end up including two baskets, and so one went to the Museum of Anthropology as a possible donation and was redirected to the community. So it hasn't been home yet. So they said, send it over to the Museum of Vancouver. We'll put that one in the show.
Yeah.
And then the larger round basket was purchased by one of their youth PL at an auction. And so he loaned it to us for the show. And then he and another fellow, Dakota, also made all these projectile points around it. And some of the young ladies made beadwork and other items they wanted to include. So the flow of the exhibit is to kind of follow the room around and then end up in the theater section. So we have a section about the knowledge of their basketry with Shekau Kitse, which is also the name of the film. And then there's a section that talks about how they lost some of the baskets in their community. And there is some mention of residential school. So we do have a warning outside the main doors.
Right.
And then they talk about, but it's really about the return and the celebration. And it leads into the film that documents that experience. And we have a touch table with some belongings as well. So you can, pieces that their youth selected and sent down, like obsidian nodules. So this is the kind of stone that a lot of the projectile points are made out of.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, it's very sharp when it's worked with. But they sent it sort of in a nodule form, so you can handle it and you won't cut yourself. But you can see, like, it can be sharpened up quite good. And they sent some deer antlers, horsehair, sweetgrass, and a cradle. Yeah, and then there's also, like, some first-person accounts of the experience and then the film. And then in the second gallery, do you want me to just move into the second gallery?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. So in the second gallery, in the second gallery, we continue with our repatriation story. So we have a timeline about activity at the museum. So I have a much broader timeline than this, but it's like little snapshots of what are we up to at the museum, starting with active collecting in the 1890s, then new attitudes emerging in the 60s and 70s, and Indigenous agency being recognized in the 80s, and then how the repatriation policy came to be, and some of the work we've done, and a few of the objects in this section are gifts that we received from some of our repatriation work. And then to the right is the work of repair. So this is just a section that spotlights a few of the objects in the collection, mm-hmm. And sort of connects them to the people who made them or the communities they came from. And so, like in the instance of this Ellen Neal model, this was like a focal point of the museum at one time when it was commissioned by the museum. And then we kind of lost the story of it, and we also lost the base, so it couldn't be assembled. So right. This building, this little house, hadn't been assembled since mm-hmm. the 70s. And so we thought Mungo Martin had created it, but through our research, we discovered it was Ellen Neal, which is his niece. And then we worked with the family and consulted with them, and we rebuilt. We built a new base for it so we could assemble it again and sort of share it with the public. So, like, that's a bit of it's a physical repair, but it's also a repair with the family.
Right.
Yeah. And, did you want to ask a question?
I was just going to say, you mentioned how the community only had four examples of the baskets we were looking at a moment ago.
Yeah.
And now through the process of repatriation, they have a much larger collection at their community that they can look at. That sounds really important for the community.
Oh, yeah, it's really important. Like, they actually own the display cases in the other room, too, and they have matching ones in their community.
Yeah.
So they have a national government where six nations are working together. Yeah. And so they've sent the display cases, from what I understand, will be sent to each of the communities, and then the baskets will travel through them. So they're currently, I think, in Williams Lake at the head office, but there's plans for them to be rotated through the community so different people can see them. And so there were also archaeological tools and a pair of snowshoes and I want to say a knife sheath. Yeah. So there's like 61 items that went back, and only about 30 were baskets. So. Yeah, so they had four, and I think the province had given them to them as part of it, like as a gift or something. They were working on together, but they had been purchased, right? Like, so they had, when they came down for our repatriation, they visited the Museum of Anthropology. There's like a larger collection there, and they're actively searching in the United States as well. So.
Yeah, you don't, sometimes you hear about the issue, repatriation in the news, and it's not, I mean, I think that's a really sort of telling story about how significant it is, because when you just sort of hear that as someone who's not from those communities, you don't necessarily realize in tangible ways the disruption that the whole colonial period created, the sort of...
Yeah, so like there's lots of reasons for loss of knowledge, loss of people, for various reasons, illness, death. There's like the loss of knowledge from the schools, from social services taking and scooping kids. Even from urbanization and pollution, you lose access to certain resources or lack of biodiversity. So we're really aware of that in our work here. And we're like, I'll show you knowledge repatriation because that really addresses some of that. So the first year of knowledge repatriation was about coiled cedar root basketry. So the coiled root basketry is like quintessentially Salish basketry here. And many people have it in their homes, but not very many people practice it anymore. It's actually, like, a lot of people do the cedar bark. That's a lot easier to work with. The root is actually quite challenging. Like, it's specialized knowledge, and it's quite hard to do. And I've been familiar with, like, examples of people trying to revive it in the States, and the elders wouldn't teach people outside their families. So we're very lucky that this lady, Gay Williams, on the monitors behind us, agreed to come down and teach Host Nations community members. And she allowed us to film and photograph her and to make, we're going to make curriculum. We have a grant to make some curriculum kits. So that's the next stage of this. So we did all, because my grandmother and my great-grandmother were root weavers, and I didn't get a chance to learn. So I structured it as I would want to learn. So we did all the harvesting first, and we filmed it all. And then we made tiny little canoe baskets. Yeah. Took 2 days. So this one is actually mine, and I gave it to the museum. Because it's our teachings that when you make something for the first time, you give it away.
Right.
And that's so you're, like, generous, and it's not good to be stingy. So anyway, so I gave it away to document the work we were doing. And then I kept a few small samples of some of the materials we gathered. So the cherry bark we gathered at the Jericho Lands, and we had folks from the Parks Board help us with access. Mm-hmm. Canary grass was from Stanley Park. And then we went up into the watershed of the Seymour Demonstration for roots and saplingwood. And so these were all done at different times of the year before we were ready to like make our baskets. And so we're going to be building some curriculum kits. There'll be one for the general schools, but it won't be as detailed as the ones for the community. Because with lack of access, we really don't, want everybody out know, doing it. But I've had a thought about basket bottoms. And you can go to Michael's and buy popsicle sticks and end up with slats, very similar to what we're working with.
Yeah.
So you could do it with raffia and like popsicle sticks. You don't have to necessarily... you know, go and harvest roots and do it. So we can, I mean, there's other ways to teach, right? So,
Well, this is very interesting and some really wonderful items to see in the display and the story. You know, I love the bit about, you know, creating a curriculum to, I don't know if it's revive is the right term, but to make the art, make the skill and the art accessible to the communities.
Yeah, so this actually grew out of the first year with the root basketry, grew out of the work I did for That Which Sustains Us.
Yeah.
And we were doing that during COVID. And so Musqueam had suggested that we have somebody make a root basket and we film it and we put Hank Aminum and Squamish Snitchum to it. And then a few months later, because of COVID, it's really hard to gather, right? So then they kind of came back and said, we can't do this right now. Maybe we could put a pause on it. So after That Which Sustains Us, I had a meeting with some of the communities and we talked about, like, what can we do for you? Like what could we do that's for the communities and not necessarily for the museum? And so then this came up again. So then I organized, like this one. And then the second year was about connecting across the Salish Sea. So we did visits for that one. We went down to Washington State and visited Ed Carrier. He's a very famous elder down there. He reconstructs archaeological basketry with cedar branches. And he also, he knows so much. He makes fish traps. And so we filmed making like duck nets out of stinging nettle fiber. How he works on the fish traps and how to make tule mats. And we went to a sea garden because Tsleil Waututh is very interested in that knowledge. Sometimes they call them clam gardens, but there's many other things, I guess, that grow in them. So, yeah.
Fascinating and interesting and really...
Yeah.
I love how positive a story it is.
Well, yeah, I think people get afraid about repatriation, but the reality is there's a lot of belongings in the museum collections that aren't very well documented, which is why we did the work of repair project. But there's still many like where we just don't know where they came from. So it's and sometimes communities want us to hang on to things for a while till they're ready. But the idea is that if you have good relationships and you want to do an exhibition, then those communities will work with you to tell their story, how they want to tell it. And if they want to loan it to you, they'll loan it to you, right? So, and I'm doing contemporary collecting, right? We're trying to reshape the collection so that it's like an ethical collection. We're supporting emerging artists and people who show like tradition as ongoing. And
I guess that sort of addresses one last question I wanted to ask you about how do you balance... having items to tell the stories you're trying to tell so that you have things you can show with repatriation to the communities. But it's not really an either-or argument or situation, is it?
I mean, no. We've chosen to prioritize the relationships.
Yeah.
So, we're just working with the communities as best we can to tell their stories when they think it's appropriate.
Yeah.
And engagement happens on a number of fronts. So exhibition work, we're working kind of with the nations and their representatives. But our programming might be like working with artists from the different communities. So I have a colleague, Jasper, who works a lot with the programming. And then I'm supporting the education team with like new curriculum development and reviewing new curriculum. Yeah. So it's like very multifaceted, but it really all starts with having good relations.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's a fascinating show, and people should come down and see it.
Oh, good. I hope they do.
That was Sharon Fortney, curator for the new exhibition at the MOV, or the Museum of Vancouver, The Work of Repair, Redress and Repatriation at the Museum of Vancouver. That exhibition is running down at the Museum of Vancouver throughout the summer and into the fall. Really fascinating exhibition. And of course, there's two others going on at the same time. You can also check out the Future Makers exhibition and the Deep-Seated Histories exhibition. Deep-Seated Histories, Chairs from the Collection. Also ongoing right now at the Museum of Vancouver.
This is Bird Note. There are many ways we can help birds, from installing nest boxes to buying bird-friendly coffee. Acclaimed writer Amy Tan's efforts have ranged from joining the board of the American Bird Conservancy to making her yard a haven for her feathered friends.
I try to get the best food for them. I try all these solutions for protecting them from both window collisions and cats, with the idea that these might help other people adopt these measures.
She came up with a creative and affordable option for bird-friendly window treatments to help deter birds from flying into the glass.
I wanted to find a solution that anybody with $2 could do to protect birds, and that is to draw white spider webs with an acrylic water-based pen.